This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. At first glance, David Halperin's new novel seems like a straight sci-fi tale. Journal of a UFO investigator is about a teenager looking for flying saucers. He's abducted, father's a humo-alien hybrid, and it all sounds like an episode of The X-Files, right? But there's another story running through the fantasy. It's about an adolescent dealing with loneliness, growing up in the impending death of his mother. The author drew upon his own troubled childhood and his expertise as a UNC religion professor when he wrote the novel. He's going to be at Park Road Books in Charlotte reading this Saturday. But first, David Halperin is in the studio now to tell us about Journal of a UFO Investigator. David Halperin, welcome to State of Things.
Well, I'm delighted to be here, Frank. Thank you for having me.
It is so good to have you. This Journal of a UFO Investigator, tell us what it's about.
It's a reimagining of the myth of the UFOs, entwined with the deepest longings of a teenage boy.
You have been interested in UFOs. This is something that interests you.
Yeah, I myself was a teenage UFO investigator back many, many years ago, back in the 1960s. And then I grew beyond it. I became eventually a professor of religious studies. But then I found, what was I studying when I did religious studies? I was studying the visions of Ezekiel, which we always used to say were UFOs.
Remind us about Ezekiel's vision.
Yeah, that Ezekiel sees a great wind come out of the north with fire flashing up, living creatures with four faces and wheels.
So you have this vision in texts that are more than 5,000 years old, that have been the subject of a great deal of interpretation. Mm-hmm. It grew its own branch of mysticism, Merkaba mysticism.
Yes, indeed.
People have been thinking about this for a long, long time.
Oh, yeah.
And it's serious stuff. But the idea of an adolescent also having these longings and these all kind of visions, in a way, prophecies. Tell us how these two ideas come together.
That Danny Shapiro gets involved with the modern myth of the UFOs, with all of its accompanying legends, like the legend of the three men in black who visit those who've discovered the secret of the UFOs or who've come dangerously near it, and then they terrorize these people into silence. And Danny sort of half-consciously finds himself drifting toward becoming an actor in these legends, that he in fact encounters the three men in black. He becomes part of the legend associated with the Philadelphia experiment, the ship that turns invisible. That he goes in search of a lost annotated book that contains in it the secrets of UFOs and invisibility. And he finds himself going down a rabbit hole that's not so easy to get out of once he's in it.
So there it is, the mystery and the tale of the UFO investigator, or at least the first part of that. But there's also a backstory. Danny comes from a home, and there's a lot going on there.
Yes. Yes, his mother is not only sick with a heart condition, which Danny more or less knows, but she's also slowly dying, which Danny sees before his eyes, but he doesn't see it, and he knows it only intermittently.
He's coping with all of this, and he finds, in fact, somebody else who's investigating these UFO sightings. And it takes him into another world and a whole other set of friends. Tell us about his new set of friends now.
Well, there's the first one he encounters, Julian Margulies, who is witty, just a touch sinister, and you can't quite pin him down. Whenever you think he's going to tell you straight, he makes a joke or slides away from it. And then there's Rochelle. Beautiful, blonde, turns out to be an accomplished seductress and also an accomplished thief. Only When Danny gets very deep into the rabbit hole, she turns out to be the wise woman, who's his friend and helps him make sense of it all.
And in a sense, Danny is running away from an earlier crush that he had.
Yes.
And so tell us about that and his...
With one of his classmates, whose name is Rosa. And every now and then he gets Rosa and Rochelle confused in his mind. Who is a girl, he can't date her because he's Jewish and she's not. And he intuitively feels that if he gets involved with her, even dancing with her, that's going to make his sick mother even worse. And yet, not only does he have a crush on her, but she's rather sweet on him, and in fact turns out to be the truest and most loyal friend he has.
There's a lot going on in this book. Now, we've got a lot of threads coming together.
Yes.
A very recognizable story of adolescent romance thwarted on the one hand because of family complications, finding new friends, all of that sounds, and then this kind of paranormal, the second story. And they're going along in parallel, and then they kind of come together at the end when Danny's world begins to dissolve.
Yes, that's very, very well put.
What's happening there? What's happening toward the end of this novel, or as it begins to come together?
I don't want to put out any spoilers here, so let me just say that Danny experiences his going into the UFO world as a way of keeping his mother from dying. And it begins to become clear to him that it's not going to work.
Talking with David Halperin, his new novel is called Journal of a UFO Investigator. And this, the life of Danny Shapiro, is very close to the life of David Halperin, isn't it?
Well, part of it, yes. I was a UFO investigator, like Danny, but I did not, for example, have a UFO fall out of the sky on top of me.
Nor did you father a humo-alien hybrid.
Nor did I meet anyone remotely like Rochelle. Uh-huh. But I will tell you that I had a dream when I was a teenager. I remember it from that period. Whether correctly or not, I don't know. But I do remember having had it, in which I was in a rambling old house at a meeting of a society of hyper-serious teenagers like myself, interested in exploring the mysteries beyond the borders of science. And there among them was a beautiful blonde.
And you also were dealing with a mother whose death was imminent.
Yes.
And in a family where we were going to talk about that, right?
Exactly.
How did that affect you as a young man?
I think it made me a UFO investigator, and I will tell you why. That when I was 12 going on 13, which is about the age of Danny, is when he becomes a UFO investigator, I read a book called They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers by Gray Barker about the three men in black. I read it and I instantly believed, because I knew that book was telling the truth about a secret so terrible that you didn't dare to talk about it. Of course, it was the secret in a somewhat distorted mirror. But, I mean, sometimes you need to use mirrors.
Well, and that's it. I think that this book is a great psychological thriller filled with those sorts of insights. Was this a book? And it was a long time coming. You spent years writing this novel, didn't you?
14 years, yes.
Were you conscious of the fact that this might have been some way of processing all of that, your own childhood and adolescence?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, ever since I came to realize that the farther I thought I was getting away from UFOs by going into Judaic studies, I was actually researching UFOs under a different guise, that I began to realize, look, this myth not only has meaning for our culture, which is why it won't go away, but it had tremendous personal meaning for me. And the only way I could deal with that, the only way I could express that, was to tell a story based partly on who I was when I was a teenager, but partly on what I dreamed and what I imagined when I was a teenager.
That, if we stick with the personal side of this for just a moment, that really is the turbulence of adolescence, isn't it? Trying to some way or another come up with an identity. And what we imagine is something you try to live up to. If you're going to be a UFO investigator, you got to go find them and like-minded people.
Yes, indeed. Now, I mean, in reality, there were ways you could do that back in the 1960s. You exchanged 10 and 20-page letters with other kids. Almost all of us were boys. Girls didn't go in for this.
Well, that's because you guys were always having dreams about them, and they didn't want to put up with all the whatever it was you were going to do when you saw them.
Yeah, or maybe they wanted us to actually ask them out and not just have these fantasies. But if there were reasons why we couldn't, then we stayed with the fantasies.
So you're able to write letters. There were other like-minded people, and that helped support the fantasies. You know, on the collective level, there was a spate of UFO sightings, certainly right after World War II. This is and it shouldn't surprise us that it coincides with an anxiety about nuclear warfare and our own futures on the threshold of the Cold War and all of that. We do, and as somebody who studied ancient scripture and particularly interested in mystical scripture, this is it not, a kind of expression of social anxiety when we begin to see things, when mystics among us begin to express visions and we pay attention?
Well, I'm pretty convinced that what UFOs are basically about is death, the intimate alienness that we're brought. I mean, my death was born with me. It's with me every day of my life. It grows with me. And yet it's also the most alien thing that I can not conceive. I really can't conceive it. It's so alien. And I think that the late 1940s, when the UFOs became a definable cultural phenomenon, this was when it first became a realistic possibility that the whole species could die.
That fear is still with us, and yet we at least hear about fewer UFO sightings these days. What do you think has changed?
I think UFOs have other things to do nowadays than be seen flittering through the skies. That Roswell, which was almost unknown until about 1980, has become a central legend of ufology, as we call it. For a long time, the UFO abductions were tremendously important. Well, even while people weren't seeing UFOs up in the sky. So I think that the UFOs take different form.
Now, there are those who would say that religion itself, that all religions, because of their mysticism and because of the ultimate otherness of the deity, should this religion have a deity, is in fact this form of fantasy. It's a way of us coping with what is ultimately a psychological and not a religious problem. How would you answer that?
Well, I'd quote the late Forrest Church, a Unitarian minister, who said that the essence of religion is our human response to the dual reality that we're alive and we know we're going to die. So I think that to say that it's psychological, it in no way diminishes it as a religious phenomenon.
In other words, it can be a psychological phenomenon. That doesn't mean there isn't something other, something more powerful and something awesome that's out there.
Yeah, or perhaps it's something, let's assume for a moment, that there is nothing more awesome, more powerful out there. There is no God. There are no UFOs. Let's assume that for a moment. Our dilemma before our mortality is still the same. And we have to deal with it somehow. The ancient Epicureans thought of all sorts of nice sayings that would make the fear of death go away. And yet it stayed. terrified them.
Did you come to any other understanding? How have your ideas about the ultimate questions changed as a result of writing the book?
I think they have, in that I understand that the best way to explore myth is to have been a part of it, and to tell that story, to tell your own myth.
How about, I know it was difficult for you growing up and then finally having to encounter the death of your mother, a story that was not being told around the mm-hmm. house. Have you been able to cope with that in a different way now that you've written this book?
I think it was probably the other way around. I think probably understanding what I needed to cope with was what made it possible for me to write the book. Mm. But yes, I think you're right. I think that through writing the book, I came to understand a great deal better what was going on in those years, say from 13 to 17, yes.
And what was going on in the family? Why do you think it's so difficult for not only your family but others to talk about these things and help their children process them?
My guess is that those who are not sick feel a tremendous guilt toward those who are. Probably also resentment. Certainly also resentment. How could they not? And with the resentment, even more guilt.
David Halperin, thank you so much for being on the program.
And thank you for having me, Frank.
David Halperin is a professor of religion at UNC Chapel Hill and author of Journal of a UFO Investigator. He'll be at Park Road Books in Charlotte at 2 o'clock on Saturday. You can learn more about him at davidhalperin.net. That's the state of things for today. Thanks for listening. If you want to hear an archived edition of a past program, go to our website, stateofthings.org. Check us out on Facebook. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.